African-American women are not newcomers to biblical interpretation, says Dr. Nyasha Jr. in her book, An Introduction to Womanist Biblical Interpretation. For centuries, women of African descent living on this continent have heard, read, improvised, preached on, and riffed off of biblical texts. Texts which have often been used to silence, erase, and oppress them. Listen in as the Reverend Janae Pitts Murdoch discusses Black women in and the Bible. I am the Reverend Broderick Greer, curate at Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church and School, and this is Theology Live, a contemporary theology series. So, Janae, the Reverend Janae Pitts Murdoch, tell us who you are and what you do and why you do it.
Well, good to be with you, Father Broderick. For the listeners, that's an inside joke. Well, I am a woman who believes in the full humanity of all women. I am a woman who is graced to be wife and mother, daughter. I am graced to be friend and soror, preacher, theologian, community worker. And just like my life is complex and complicated, there are so many other women in the world who also have complicated lives. But in that complication, show forth the full glory of the God we serve. I also have the privilege of living here in Memphis and being able to be minister in the pulpit, as well as being a minister of sorts in civil service as an employee in the Memphis Public Library system.
And what exactly do you do with the Memphis Public Library System?
My my title there is Teen Services Coordinator. And so I coordinate programs for teens ages 13 to 18 in our 18 public library locations. I've also had the joy of launching a very innovative teen learning lab called Cloud 901, where we transform Memphis youth from information consumers into information creators.
Wow. Important transformative work happening right here in Shelby County. Mm-hmm. So that's are honored to have you with us tonight talking about Black women in and Black women and the Bible. I was thinking about this actually today in preparation for our conversation, that the first people who read the Bible to me were Black women.
Oh, yeah.
My mother and my grandmother and my aunt and many women in the church that I grew up in. Mm-hmm. Who were the first Black women to read the Bible to you?
My mom was the first Black woman, the first woman, the first person to read the Bible to me. My first teacher in Sunday school was a Black woman. And the first person to tell me I was called to the preaching ministry was a Black woman.
Interesting.
And I am very clear that while women do not have the privilege of power in the universal church, they are definitely power brokers.
Yes.
So yes. I am fortunate, though, that I've had women in my life, Black women in particular, who have helped to shape and nurture me into the woman that I am today, a few of which are in the audience today.
Awesome. Can you talk about your relationship with them?
Absolutely. There is one woman in particular who I will lift. She is the newly installed senior minister at Lindenwood Christian Church, which is a predominantly white congregation. She is not predominantly white.
And listeners of our podcast will be familiar with this person because she was our guest in December.
She was, mm-hmm. and she talked about the theology of vulnerability,
yes,
I think it was.
Yes.
And that is the Reverend Verzola Jonan Law.
Wow.
When I arrived in Memphis in 08, she was associate pastor at Mississippi Boulevard Christian Church, which was the congregation that I was coming to join also as assistant, as a associate pastor. And she helped to shape and nurture my spiritual disciplines. She helped me to experience God in very new and profound ways. She is pastor and shepherd par excellence.
Wow.
And I have been so very fortunate to watch spirituality through her eyes, as well as see how it can be lived in the world through the way that she has done it. And now that she sits in a very historic spot as the first African-American female to be senior minister at the church, is what, 180 years old? 162 years
wow.
old. To be the first African American and the first woman to be installed as their senior minister just says, you know, so much. And then, in addition to Pastor Law, also in our audience is Pastor Nakisha Weston, who also I served with at Mississippi Boulevard Christian Church, and she is a firecracker.
Mm-hmm.
And probably a firecracker on steroids. But her passion for developing children and youth in the walk of the Lord has been remarkable to watch. And even her passion, all three of us had the opportunity to show what female ministry or female leadership ministry could look like as mothers, as daughters, and as Black women. So it's been my privilege to have been able to serve alongside women like that.
Well, and we are honored to have them with us tonight. Thank you all so much. If you could, we had a conversation last week in preparation for this evening, and it was so rich that I think I said I wish that had just been recorded and that was it. You know, like, that was perfect. If you could, talk to me again about the Black women that you see in the Bible.
Mm. Well, the conversation that we had the other day really gave me an opportunity to discuss some of my favorite characters in the Bible. Two women who are generally overlooked, and two women who, when preached, are preached badly. And those women would be Jephthah's daughter in Judges 11 and Queen Vashti in Esther chapter 1.
Now, we are Episcopalians, so we don't know who Jephthah's... I grew up Baptist, so I know who Jephthah's daughter is, but there are some Episcopalians in the room who may not know who Jephthah's daughter is. Can you please tell us?
I will gladly tell you. Well, there's a story in Judges chapter 11. No. So there is a man in Judges 11 who is the son of Gilead and a prostitute. His name is Jephthah. And Jephthah is rejected by his brothers because he is the son of the other woman. So his half-brothers, Jephthah's half-brothers, reject him and say, you will have no part of any inheritance in our family. And they despise him, they alienate him, they ostracize him, so much so that he pretty much goes into exile into another land. Well, Israel falls into danger and they need a warrior to lead them into battle. But Jephthah was the best warrior they had. So they ended up having to go back to Jephthah and ask him if he would come back and lead them into battle. So this seems like wonderful payback for Jephthah. You all rejected me, you alienated me, you ostracized me, you all kicked me out of town, but now you need my help. So Jephthah has the opportunity to redeem his name, to go into battle, to redeem his name and also to redeem the Israelites, right? Well, Jephthah makes a vow to the Lord and says, God, if you grant me victory in this battle, I will sacrifice whatever comes to the door when I return home from battle. Dumb. Because when he returns home from battle, when he returns home from his victorious battle, the first person who comes to the door is his daughter, his only daughter. And he says to his daughter, you have brought me low this day because I made a vow to the Lord and I cannot break it. And so his daughter's life is on the line because he made a reckless vow to the Lord. I'm calling it reckless. He made a reckless vow to the Lord that now he feels compelled to follow through on. And then his daughter, in a very, in what I would consider a very stereotypical way of depicting weak women, says, Father, whatever you say, do unto the Lord as you have vowed. And she, in essence, volunteers her life to be sacrificed.
So if this is the Hunger Games, she's saying, I volunteer as tribute, basically. Yes.
Exactly. Yes. So she says, but if you would just grant me this one thing, give me 2 months to go off into the hills, to mourn with my friends, to mourn that I will never marry. So Father gives her permission to go off roaming in the hills for 2 months. And she comes back after 2 months and he kills her. Terrible story. But one, for me, that is indicative of the ways in which women's lives are often minimized and often used as currency for men in power and leadership. And while Jephthah made a vow to God, Jephthah would have rather sacrificed his daughter's life than to have owned up to the mistake of the vow or suffer the consequences of having made a bad vow. And often in contemporary society, women's lives are sacrificed on the altar for men's ego, men's position, and men's power. And I just see Jephthah's daughter as such a wonderful but terrible example of the lives that so many black women, or actually I'll say women in general, but particularly black women, live today.
And in our conversation, you mentioned that this is a story about reckless masculinity and religious fanaticism. Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit more about that as it relates to black women?
So it is no secret that many families in the black community lack male presence, and that due to whatever circumstances have prompted it, many girls and boys grow up in households without the presence of men. And in circumstances when men are present, they do not always present themselves as healthy representatives of leadership or advocates of female humanity. And so when I refer to reckless masculinity, it is the wielding of masculine power, of what it means to be a man, that stereotypical leader, protector, provider, all of those labels that are provided to the male role. And that in this context, in Judges 11, Jephthah abandons his role as protector, father, nurturer, and instead yields to his place as warrior, leader, and I use the phrase fanaticism, so religious fanaticism, in that there are some of us who lose our minds in the name of religion, that we relinquish our ability to think and to reason. We relinquish our responsibility to see the other as human and instead negate the responsibility that we have to the world around us in the name of God.
Yes. And really, this is, it's just a projection of our own kind of fanciful fetishes of domination, unfortunately.
Yeah. I like that you use the word fetish. No, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that that's a choice word because too often religious fanatics, I think you had a session, a podcast on this a couple months ago, that religious fanatics really relinquish or deny that God invests in us decision-making power, that God invests in us the opportunity to make choices that will not only honor God, but that will affirm God's creation.
Yes.
And so, you know, the story with Jephthah's daughter, for me, is so indicative of people who, in the name of God, just dehumanize others. And unfortunately, Black women are often dehumanized, even in the churches where they are, where they fund, where they participate. You know, Black women sacrifice themselves on the altars of Baptist, Kojic, Methodist churches, Episcopal, I don't know. All the time.
Absolutely. If you could speak to Queen Vashti.
I love Queen Vashti. So Queen Vashti is in Esther chapter 1. Most people have no idea who Queen Vashti is because they never read Esther 1. They start at Esther 2. They start when Esther, when you know they don't start with the woman who made room for Esther. They begin with the knight in shining armor who comes and saves the little damsel in distress who's hanging out with her uncle Mordecai. But Queen Vashti is in Esther chapter 1, and she is the wife before Esther, or the queen before Esther. And because of her revolt or her revolutionary actions, she is deposed as queen. Her husband, King Ahasuerus, has a banquet for all of his nobles and all of his leaders that lasts 180 days. There is no end to the drinking. There's no end to the revelry. And then at the end of this banquet for 180 days, he has another banquet for everybody in all of his provinces for another 7 days. And at the end of all of that partying, of all of that drinking, the king tells his eunuchs, go get Queen Vashti because she's lovely to look at. And I want her to come and walk in front of all of my guests. So they've been drinking and partying and hanging out for 187 days. And he says, go get my wife because I want to show her off in front of all of my guests. Now, Dr. Andre Johnson, who is in the audience here, is reminding me that he wanted her to model naked with only a crown. Now, scholars will debate what she was wearing, whether she was naked and only wearing the crown, or if, you know, she was scantily clad with the crown. But what we know is folks have been partying for 187 days. And he wants her to model the crown in front of his friends. Now, the reason why I love this story is because Vashti says, no, I'm not going to do it. For whatever reason, she says no. And because she says no, the king is forced to take action. One, because he cannot be seen as weak in front of his subjects. And then two, he has to make an example of Queen Vashti, because his nobles say, King, if you don't do something about her, then all the wives and all the land will say, the king asked Queen Vashti to come and she wouldn't. And all the women and all the land will follow Queen Vashti's lead. King, you have to do something. And so the king was like, well, what do I do? And they were like, well, we think that you should remove her and give her position to someone else who is better than she. So Queen Vashti gets deposed because she says no. She says no to being eye candy. She says no to being a sex object. She says no to being the tool of man's satisfaction. And because she says no to being objectified, she is then, these are Janae's words, she is then for eternity marked as a bad wife. And wow. A bad queen and a bad woman. Because no woman says no to her husband, regardless as to what he asks. But Queen Vashti says, I resist the assumption that I will be the tool for your satisfaction. And I resist the notion that I have no agency and that I have no power in choosing how my body, my presence, my mind is demonstrated or portrayed to others. So I love her. I love Queen Vashti.
So you're saying, and tell me if I'm wrong, that maybe kind of in the American psyche, American mythos about black women, that black women are often... they don't often have agency. And even though this is not true, there is this concept that they don't often say no, that they don't often make their own decisions. And you're saying that Queen Vashti is kind of personifying what you understand black womanhood as being.
Yes. And to make the point further, we don't preach about Vashti. We only preach about Esther. We only preach about that woman who does exactly what her eunuch tells her to when she gets called into the kingdom. The one who follows instructions. And the one time that she chooses to be rebellious, if you will, when she goes before the king without being summoned, she even goes there meek. You know, if I die, let me die. You know, or she goes under the auspices of Mordecai's words. You know, you were called for such a time as this. Why can't she just go because she want to go? Why can't she go because she feels called and compelled to advocate and speak up for herself or for her people? And so I love humanizing Queen Vashti and restoring her personhood. Because if it were not for Queen Vashti, perhaps there would have been no Esther. Yes. If there had not first been a woman to push back against the grain, against what was expected, then there would have been no happily ever after for Vashti. And for so many black women who end up with the short end of the stick for being the first girlfriend, the first wife, or the one who ends up divorced with the kids. Yeah. Right? Who often gets, y'all, this audience is getting out of hand. but really, for the ex-woman who is left with the baggage from the relationship, who is often demonized because of the choices she made that were not acceptable in that relationship. And because she made choices that were not acceptable in that relationship, that were necessary for her own survival and that were necessary for her own personhood, you know, she gets overlooked, she gets dehumanized, she gets demonized. And that ain't right. Vashti made a decision for her own survival and for her own personhood. And I think that she deserves to be celebrated for that. Not taking anything away from Esther. I mean, thank God for Esther. But, you know, whenever I talk about Vashti, I often say more of us have been Vashti than have been Esther.
Wow.
And we do women a disservice with always preaching and teaching about Esther, and not acknowledging that more of us have been Vashti, and you should be celebrated for pursuing your own humanity and personhood and doing what's necessary for your own survival.
Do you think in this kind of reckless masculinity kind of complex and mindset that there's something advantageous about making black women two-dimensional or passive or without agency?
It's interesting you should ask a black woman if there's anything beneficial about making us passive, because we, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, that, and I may have been having this conversation with Pastor Nakisha Weston, that women are strong. And in so many contexts, you know, it's said that women are emotional, right? I mean, we are often sort of characterized as being emotional. And I'm like, that is hogwash, because women have the most enduring bodies ever. If your body, men,
and I do
went through half of the stuff that women's bodies go through in a 30-day period, that is strength at its best. We endure hormonal changes. We endure physical changes. We endure, our bodies endure so much. And that's just when we're just existing. Not to mention if we are carrying babies, right? Women who carry babies are like superhuman, because their pelvises expand, the uterus grows, their cartilage expands. All sorts of things are happening to places that you will never see.
I will never see.
The sisters in the room, any women in the room who've ever carried a baby, whether it was for a little bit or a long time, have experienced sensations in places you didn't know existed. Women are strong. And to be called emotional is not only an insult, but it's ignorant.
Wow.
Because we are so strong. Our bodies are strong. Our minds are strong. To manage the negative perceptions that society has of us, the biblical interpretation, and sometimes even the biblical text that is described about us, to carry all of that and then still go to work and be twice as good as the brother in the cubicle next to us, to go to a graduate program or to go to college and still get the 4.0, to work full time, to take care of family and friends and everyone else and not fall apart, I mean, that's strength. So I think it's advantageous to some people to get to your question. I think it's advantageous for some people to classify women as passive because we are so strong. And if our full strength were really given space to show, it would change the power dynamic. And it would change the pieces on the table. The good thing is, and I think where God's grace is shown, is that every man is not intimidated by women. And every man does not seek to dehumanize women. That there are men in the world who, even from their places of power and privilege, seek to include women, to include their voices and to include their gifts and affirm them not as properties or as tools, but as partners. You know, there are so many who advocate for the full humanity of women. And as a consequence, women like me have the courage, the audacity to actually speak up and to talk like I'm talking.
Absolutely.
And a few of those guys are in the room. You know, I'll just name Dr. Andre Johnson right now, who works diligently to affirm all humanity, regardless of whatever label society puts on us. And I think the grace of God is that even when particular norms seek to silence us or seek to make us impotent, that there are people in power positions who make room for our full humanity.
Well, we could end there, but I have another question. You have talked about an interest in Mary, and can you just say a little bit about Mary, the mother of Jesus?
He is asking me all these deep questions. I love Mary, the mother of Jesus, but I am troubled by how she's personified. So she is a young girl minding her own business who is engaged to be married to a good man. And all of a sudden, here comes Holy Spirit. Holy Spirit says, you have found favor with the Lord. Favor? How do you call this favor? I am minding my own business, about to get married to a good man. And now you want to cover me with your light? Impregnate me? with a trouble kid. So not only do I have to navigate the waters of explaining this, how I'm a virgin and now pregnant, to my soon-to-be husband, I then have to navigate those very difficult waters and then raise a problem child. And I use the phrase problem child because Black boys in contemporary society are labeled as problem children because their view of the world is different than the normative view of the world. And their behavior patterns are often different than the behavior patterns of non-Black children. And Black mothers and fathers have to navigate these tender and sensitive waters with trying to explain to people how your child is different, but still normal.
Yes.
So Mary has to explain how her son is showing up in synagogues knowing more than the rabbi and calling God his father and still having to explain to people, I know he seems different, but he's really normal. And then when he is then as gifted as he is, as special as he is, and as wonderful a work as Jesus does in the world, is then arrested, persecuted, and beaten in her face. And then she has to watch the system kill her son. And we preach her like she watches it with no problem. We preach it, we teach it, we talk it like Mary is meek and mild and just accepts watching her son be murdered in front of her. And I love Mary because I have two boys. I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. And while I wasn't a virgin when I got pregnant, I mean, my husband and I really enjoyed, you know, the process of bringing them into the world. That I cannot imagine having done all that work through their childhood, having to defend them, affirm them, protect them, teach them, raise them, nurture them, and then when they become adults, for them to be persecuted and beaten and treated in the way that Jesus was treated. I mean, we just celebrated Easter, and I'm sure many of us talked about Mary being at the foot of the cross in a very passive way, but I can't imagine that any mother, any woman, after having sacrificed that much to get their child to adulthood, can sit at the foot of a cross and just accept their child's demise. So I think that Mary in many ways also reflects the life of Black women who work real hard to get their sons to adulthood. And And then once they get them there, the world just pounces on them. And then, you know, the world expects you to be quiet. The world expects you to and not to hyper-criticize any women who have recently lost their sons, but the world just expects you to jump to forgiveness.
Yes.
When really you might be pissed at the foot of the cross. So Vashti, Esther, and Mary are wonderful women in the Bible who I think are either overlooked or preached as passive, when in real life, I just don't think that was the case.
Amazing. Well, we will stop there. I mean, this conversation could go for hours. And I hope that it does with our listeners, with people who are here with us tonight, that there is some texture and complexity added to how people understand Black women, complexity and texture added to how people understand how Black women interact with the biblical text. And you have just opened our minds and our hearts and our imaginations in a new and profound way. So thank you. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for this platform.
Absolutely. And if you ever want to come back, we will cancel whoever is here. And we will have you every month if we have to. So thank you so much. As long as human beings are complex and multifaceted, our interpretations of texts and narratives of the Bible will be complex and multifaceted. When we approach Scripture, we are not encountering a lifeless book, but a living library that invites us deeper into the mystery of life. And with that mystery comes the responsibility of interpreting biblical texts ethically as we consider context, texture, and language differences. We are fooling ourselves if we think any of this is easy. Theology Live is a ministry of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, a welcoming community of faith in the heart of Midtown Memphis. This episode of Theology Live was engineered and edited by Noah Glenn, who also composed our theme music. Our Theology Live logo was designed by Andy Gill. We offer special thanks to our friends at Alchemy Memphis and our guest, the Reverend Janae Pitts Murdoch. Join us next month as Dr. Courtney Pace discusses how revivalism, race, and gender all connect within American religion. Visit 901theology.com and follow us on Twitter at 901theology for updates about our live events.